All right. Well, we're about ready to get started. If you want to come find a seat, we are some seats in the front. There's still some seats in the back. Help yourself to pizza. Alex is manning the bar back there. Thank you, Alex. So we are delighted to see y'all here tonight. And Justin sends his apologies. He is running an open house for the St. Philip's School tonight, so that is why he is not here. But we are very excited that we have a great guest with us tonight, and he is the Reverend Fergus Butler Gailey, who comes to us straight from the UK. Fortunately, he and Ned Donovan are friends, so we were able to get Fergus while he was down here visiting Ned. We had a pint in the Turf Tavern.
Two pints, I think.
Or so, yes. And neither of us smashed our head on the beam, no. So that was a successful night. But we are delighted you're here. If this is your first time, welcome. You will notice there are these little sheets that are scattered around the room, and what you will find on the sheet are two very high-tech QR codes. The first QR code is for questions. So any question you have about anything, whether it's about what we're talking about or something else, you can ask it anonymously through that. And when we get to question and answer time, you can upvote the questions that you like and we will address those. The other QR code is if you are not on our Theology on Tuesdays email list, we would love for you to sign up. We have various things going on from time to time besides Theology on Tuesdays. And you also, if you've been with us for a while, you know that our mantra is that we meet every other Tuesday except when we don't. And keeping up with when we're meeting is not always easy. So if you're on the email list, you can be sure that you will always be in the know about when we're meeting. There also is on here a plug for the class that I'm teaching right now on Prince Caspian. That's on Wednesday nights. You can come at 7 for the class. If you want to come earlier for 6:15, there's an excellent free dinner. If you want to come at 5:30, there's evening prayer. We'd love to have you for any of those. We've got a good group of folks from Theology on Tuesdays coming, and Prince Caspian is an amazing book. But we're here to talk about a different topic tonight, and that is the topic of beauty and sacred space and longing and all of that. And I'm particularly happy to have Fergus with us because he has just written a book that I have managed to carry from the Turf Tavern onto Delta Airlines and through TSA and everything else and have it here tonight. And I've read 7/8 of this book, and it is really good. I'm not avoiding the last 8th. I just haven't gotten there yet. But it is excellent. It's called 12 Churches, and the subtitle is An Unlikely History of the Buildings That Made Christianity. And part of what is remarkable about it is on the cover is an endorsement from Tom Holland. Now, you may think Tom Holland, Spider-Man. But you would be wrong. This Tom Holland is the eminent historian who's written a really important book lately called Dominion that Justin and I both talked about in here several times. And Tom has written that this book is a brilliantly inventive way of telling a story that profoundly affects us all, the emergence and evolution of global Christianity. So that's a big deal. So we're excited to have Fergus with us tonight. And we're just going to chat a little bit about this. Now, I'd love to just start off by talking a little bit about what might be your favorite church building and why it speaks to your soul.
Well, thank you, Brian. It's very nice to be here with all of you. That's very difficult. I think that's a bit like asking a parent their favorite child, right? Which if you ask my parents, they say is very easy. I'm one of five children, and my brother is definitely the favorite. I think that I'm going to kind of cheat and say that my favorite church building is often with some exceptions, the one I have most recently been in, mm-hmm. because each and every church building is a kind of library of stories. It's kind of a place where so many people have come to encounter God. They've come to encounter the sacred, that I'm always captivated by whichever one I have been mm-hmm. in most recently. So Ned actually took me to the, sadly I couldn't go into St. Philip's, but went into the Huguenot Church. Mm-hmm. And that's a kind of astonishing space and something so different to what we have in England. Right. There is no right. equivalent yeah, yep. place like that. So it was completely captivating. But I have a great kind of soft spot for many of the churches I've served in. I grew up in a part of England right near the south of England. When I was a kid and you fiddled with the aerial, you used to be able to get French TV because we were closer to France than we were to London. And I was baptized in a parish called Stone in Oxney, mm-hmm. which is in a place called the Romney Marsh. It's a little bit like the kind of marshes around here, very rural, very isolated. And the font there is a former Roman wayside altar. It was a wow. pagan altar from the Roman Empire that was found on the side of one of the roads that went through the marsh in the Roman period. And what they did is they scooped out the top of it and they turned it into a baptismal font. And wow. that's just like a little story from a little thing in a church. But what an incredible sign of the kind of triumph of Christ over the kind of forces of Rome. So that has a special place for me because it's where I was put on the faith for the first time. But yeah, I will cheat and say whichever one I was in last.
That's fair. So one of the things that I really appreciated in reading this book is that there are many different churches in many different countries that use a number of different architectural idioms, and yet all of them, one of the things that comes clear in the book is that all of those places, when you go in them, there is a sense of the transcendent, mm-hmm. and there's a sense of the longing of the human spirit for beauty, for peace, for truth, for goodness, that is expressed somehow in the fabric of the buildings. And that is something that to me is somewhat astounding, because it's not obvious that architecture would do that. Mm. But I think that what you see when you look at these stories, and for many of us who live here in Charleston, where we have a lot of really beautiful historic churches, there's something about churches that cause you to have ones that are done well, that have caused you to have a sense of transcendence of the other. We often, when St. Philip's is not under construction, we often have as many as 600 to 800 tourists a day. And if you live here and are in this area, you know this is a bustling area with tourists, especially when there are cruise ships in town. Mm-hmm. But even if there are hundreds of people in the streets, people walk into the building and they're automatically silent. Their conversation drops or ceases, and they're just looking, and sometimes you hear, oh, and there's that factor about church architecture. What do you think that is about?
Well, I think it kind of goes back to this idea that what is the highest purpose that a human can have? It is the worship and service of Almighty God, right? Therefore, the highest possible calling for a physical space is the worship of Almighty mm-hmm. God. Now, in an ideal world, we'd be praising God at all times and in all places, but we live in a world where the kind of basic practicality of what it is to be a human gets in the way of that, right? And I'm sure a lot of you know that you know, Americans are actually much better at this, I have to say, bringing God into their daily lives, praying daily, praying at work, that kind of thing, than Brits are. Brits tend to delineate, they're like, I'm here in church, I'm doing my church thing, and then I'm doing other stuff.
The rest of my life. Yeah.
I think now it's more important than ever that we have these places that are set aside specifically where we can say, in the midst of these busy and difficult lives, we can say, this is where I come to bring the highest calling that I have, namely the worship of mm-hmm. Almighty God. And therefore, I think we can talk convincingly about prayed-in buildings. Mm-hmm. So it isn't just the kind of particularities of the architecture. And as you said, there's differences there from neoclassical to Byzantine to Gothic. It isn't just about the kind of design of the building, although that is interesting, and mm-hmm. we can talk about mm-hmm. that presently. And you have a vernacular here, a particular style of building in Charleston, which is very compelling for someone from across the ocean sea. But what I think is particular about churches is that they become prayed-in buildings. Mm-hmm. And so those stones bear witness. And you get this in 1 Peter, where he uses the metaphor of the living stones. And I quote that at the very start of the book, that little line from 1 Peter, you are to become like living stones. And Christ says this, you know, in the gospel, where he talks about the very stones of the temple would cry out. Mm-hmm. So there's this kind of symbiosis, this link between these physical spaces and what we do with them. And I'm a great believer, actually, I don't think this is superstitious, that what is done in a space can radically transform its feeling. Mm-hmm. And I would simply say to any of you who don't believe that, like, go to a concentration camp. It works the other way. Right. Places where, like, profound evil has happened, there is a very clear sense that there is something misaligned there. There is something evil mm-hmm. and wrong and wicked has occurred. The job of the church is to be the place where something good and faithful and beautiful and true occurs, right? So therefore, the delineation of a physical space, the making, setting aside of a space in this busy and secular world yes. to say holy and good things happen here, inevitably renders it beautiful. And I think that's what, there's something really deep in the human spirit where you recognize that, you get that, you right. feel it. You don't actually feel it in the brain, you feel it in the gut.
Yes.
And so that's why those people are gasping when they come into St. Philip's, because yes. they recognize these are well prayed in stones.
Yes, and I think it is something that we long for. And I think one of the things that's so difficult in our culture is that all of us are very busy. And I think in the American way of thinking, very often we have an unhealthily individualistic approach to faith, where it's kind of me and Jesus against the world, and I will go to church occasionally if it's convenient. But one of the things that happens, and I think your book does such a good job of talking about this, is that these spaces shape us. Mm-hmm. And so that when we are regularly spending time in a space that is prayed and holy space that's been designed by people who are trying to create a fabric that draws our souls toward God, that when we spend time regularly in those types of places, it awakens our soul. It's like that Mumford and Sons song, Awake My Soul, which I probably should have put in the playlist. It really does something to us. And one of the places that I find to be profoundly moving in the UK, that's actually where you are one of the chaplains, is that Keble College at Oxford is not the oldest college, it's one of the later colleges, but it was built as an ensemble in a very particular type of architecture. But there was a relationship going on at that time with some of the pre-Raphaelite painters and influences. And so there's a side chapel of this enormous chapel. The chapels in Keble is more like what we would think of as a giant cathedral. It's huge. But there's this little side chapel, and you go through a little unassuming door in the wall and come into this side chapel. And framed at the end of this chapel is a very famous painting that's called The Light of the World, that you've probably seen. It's Jesus carrying a lantern, knocking on a door that doesn't have a handle on it. And so it's frequently used in sermon illustrations. But when you walk into that chapel, it is almost impossible not to feel the weight of holiness in there. And people are moved by it. Sometimes you'll go in there and see people sitting for hours just in that chapel, meditating, because there's such a strong sense of the presence of Christ and the presence of prayers of generations in there. And I think part of what makes that space so successful is the ensemble of those buildings. You start off on, is that Parks Road? Parks Road, which is a busy, busy street. It's kind of like Meeting Street up by Marion Square. And you go through the Porter's Lodge gate, and all of a sudden you're out of the bustle, and there's this green lawn and all of this ensemble of buildings. And you move through that to the chapel and go up to the chapel and then in down the aisle and then through to the side chapel. And it is almost like in the temple in Jerusalem, entering into the Holy of Holies. And so there's this idea in Christian worship of entering in. Mm. And That's something that I think we don't pay a lot of attention to most of the time in our culture. We just sort of go from place to place and don't think about what does it mean to be entering into this space. But the architecture demands that you pay attention.
And I think it's actually more important than ever now. We exist in a culture where actually our experience of spaces are actually probably more limited now than they have been for many, many mm-hmm. years. How many of you work at home? Put your hand up if you work at home, if you have to do stuff, right? Okay, so you work, you have a laptop in your house. You are not necessarily even commuting. You know, you are staying in the same place. This is even what, like in the UK, this is the vast majority of people, right? So this concept of the third space, the spaces that mm-hmm. are not your work or yep. your home, has been squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. Now that can be anything. It can be a bar, it can be a barber's shop, it can be a concert venue, or it can be a church. But actually, in a culture that increasingly doesn't value, from an economic point of view, the third space, the space that isn't your home or your work, the proclamation that that space makes to the rest of the culture is even more important than ever, I would say, saying that here is a place I have set aside that is not my place of work, it's not where I go to sleep, it's not where I eat, I'm not living my life around one kitchen table. I have this place that is set aside for a specific purpose. It's kind of very countercultural. I think mm-hmm, it's worth mm-hmm. also remembering that no matter what we bring to those spaces, you talked about, you know, people coming in, exactly that, people coming in over generations, no matter what you're going through as a Christian or what you're going through in your life or your work, someone will have almost certainly brought that before to that place.
Yes.
That is a place that has probably solved the exact problem that you have before. By, you know, the fact that the prayers have been valid there. And I think it's really important, again, as we exist in these spaces where kind of lines are blurred, to have that place where actually this is a place where people bring their problems and they get solved. This is a place where people bring their joys and they mm-hmm. get celebrated. Mm-hmm. This is a place where people bring their fears and they receive courage. And I think that, again, as these kind of lines are blurred in our work and our home, to have these spaces is an increasingly radical act,
yes.
actually, and therefore all the more important to have architecture that reflects it and that moving up to God, exactly
yes.
what you said, that
yes.
kind of ascent of the soul is a kind of critical, an ever more critical thing, I think, in our
yes.
life.
And I think one of the things that goes right along with that, that was one of the original functions of churches, and you see it so much in Charleston, you don't see it so much in more what I think of as suburban towns, but one of the original ideas, and you see this in Europe, in the UK, in older churches, is that part of the role of the church, the building, was to express the beauty of God. Mm. And many people might not have had the means to live in a beautiful home, but they had a cathedral or a church that was beautiful. And it was, as you said, a third space that was open to everyone. So even if you were a poor, illiterate peasant, you could go and you could sit in that church as long as you wanted, and you could take in all of that. And one of the things that's really interesting with St. Philip's that we don't think about, we just take for granted now when we go in there, but when St. Philip's was originally built in 1723, the average ceiling height of houses in Charleston was 6.5 or 7 feet. And they very deliberately, when they built that church in 1723, decided to do this enormous barrel vault that is about, I don't know, 4 or 5 stories high. Mm. And so no one coming into that space ever saw another building that was even remotely like that. And you go in, and it's no accident that right next to the beginning of the arch in the top, there are angels, because it's to remind you that you're living under the vault of heaven. And so going into those spaces, and you see over and over again when you read history, when terrible things were happening, whether it was a hurricane or a yellow fever epidemic or whatever, people flocked into the church across all social strata. And that was the place, it was the third place where they could go. And exactly what you said, the prayers that had been uttered there helped give them strength and hope as they faced these challenges.
It's also a kind of declaration of hope in the resurrection, right?
Yes.
And the declaration of hope in the idea that death is not the end. If you particularly think of the kind of great medieval buildings of Europe, most of those took 200, 300 years to build. So someone working on like a tiny cornice, like a carved stone, would never have seen the rest of the cathedral mm-hmm. finished. And yet they put their entire heart and soul and effort into that tiny bit of carved stone because it was a declaration of faith in the wider project.
Yep.
And that's the same here. You know, there would have been people who arrived when St. Philip's had consecrated who could never have even begun to imagine that it would have still been here, you know?
Right, right.
Still standing, that it would be undergoing a restoration project, that it would have been able to gather people in a kind of bar of an evening to talk and think about religious space. And yet, they put their effort into that as a declaration of hope. And so, in our generation, and again, in particularly in a time where I think hope is often in short supply in mm-hmm. terms of the ethereal and the divine, it's our job to say, well, you know what? These people did it. You know, these people behind us, we are standing on the shoulders of giants. These people went out of their way to beautify and to be good stewards of this space, to pray in it and to use it to make this space we have. What are we doing for future generations?
Right.
Because we are bound together as a communion with those who have already gone before us.
Yep.
We are bound together, you know, with a greater cloud of witnesses. And that works both ways. You know, Christian history isn't a line. Christian history is a circle emanating out from God.
Mm-hmm.
And we are all drawn into that, whether we exist 200 years from now or 200 years past from now. So it's kind of absolutely crucial that we kind of view ourselves as part of that wider communion. And a building is a really good way to make that real, to give
right,
that physical manifestation.
It. Yeah, yeah. And one of the things that you were saying we're finding to be so true right now, while we're working on this renovation project, people that are working on it are being drawn to faith because of it. Because they see, you know, they pulled this little piece of building fabric from 1830 or whenever it might be, and they are amazed of the care and the detail that went into creating this, and thinking about why would someone do that, and that it really is an act of worship, you know, that they are doing this type of quality craftsmanship in there. So I think that part of the lesson of all of this, and part of the lesson of what you see in this book, is that we need to, particularly in our very hurried, very busy, very overcommitted, no margin lifestyles, we need to spend time in these sacred spaces, because as I said earlier, they help to form us. And being in there with the people of God is a really profound experience. One of the things I thought was so interesting in this book, you talk about the Church of the Nativity.
Mm.
The Church of the Nativity, as you probably could guess, is in Bethlehem. And it is a church with quite a history of all of these quadrants belonging to different parts of different denominations and faiths and all of that. But yet, in the midst of all of the cacophony of all of these different types of people that have a stake in the space, there still is a sense of holiness that emanates out of it. What was your main impression of that space when you
went? The thing about the Church and the Nativity is that it is the kind of center. In some ways, it's the best-known space in the world, the best-known story in the world. You could speak to people out there who have never set foot in a church in their lives, and you said, "What happened at Bethlehem?" They'd be like, "Oh yeah, that's where Jesus was born," right? It's a kind of, it's so soaked into our culture that it kind of defies mm-hmm. secularism. The story of the baby Jesus. The Church of the Nativity is an exceptionally complicated place, as you say. There's a ladder that has been up against a wall there since 1870 because no one can agree whose job it is to take it down, right? There's all these different denominations using the space. They have fights, they hit each other with brooms. It's a place that kind of speaks of the fallen nature of humanity. It suffered warfare, it suffered sieges, you know, from the Crusades all the way through to the Intifada, right? It suffered violence constantly. The fallen nature of humans has played out there in a very real way, right? And yet, it is a place that reduces people to tears
mm-hmm.
of all denominations, of all faiths. You know, there's this famous caliph in Egypt called Mad al-Hakim, who is the Islamic caliph of Egypt. He destroys all the churches in Jerusalem. He doesn't touch Bethlehem because even this kind of absolutely mad warlord sees something about this place. There's something about the incarnation, the idea of God becoming flesh. And the reason why I start with it isn't just because it's obvious and everyone's heard of Bethlehem, but because I think what happens at Bethlehem changes physical space for Christians forevermore. Mm-hmm. Because it isn't just the idea that you can think, you know, there's kind of woo-woo, you can just think, oh, if I think hard enough, I can encounter God here. It's like, no, God comes to a physical place at a specific time,
yes.
The scandal of the particular.
Yep.
And therefore, it becomes the aspiration of every church around the world, whether it's here on the shores of America, whether it's, you know, in India or Japan or in Europe. Every place then has a vocation to be a Bethlehem, right? A place where God is made known and present. And it completely changes our relationship with physical space, because that isn't just a lofty idea. It becomes...
It's a reality.
It's reality. Yep. It's heart, you know, it's atoms.
Yep.
It's stone, it's bricks and mortar. And therefore, it completely changes who we can be. It says that, you know, we are not just people who are made to kind of think like God or imitate God. We are invited as flesh to become one with God, because God became one with us by taking flesh. So it's a completely radical... It completely changes, and I would say it kind of, you know, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, nowhere has a comparable theology of place.
Yes.
Because Christianity has Bethlehem.
Yes.
So I cannot sort of say how much it's changed my thinking about physical spaces, because it means every church I encounter, to go back to your very first question, every church has the possibility to be a Bethlehem, a Jerusalem, a Nazareth, a place where God is made known to people in that space at that time, and that's an incredible thing.
Yes. And let's see how we're doing. Well, one comment before we start moving to some questions. One of the things that I find to be fascinating in Oxford particularly is that when you go to Oxford, and as most of you know, Oxford University is an assemblage of multiple colleges, 38-ish,
something like that.
But the interesting thing is they were all laid out on the monastic model originally. So they've got a big wall. They've got a refectory, which is their dining hall. They've got some classrooms and living space, and they've got a chapel. So there are, you know, dozens of college chapels. And the UK is, like the US, increasingly secular in many ways. But the interesting thing is that these chapels are still very much in use in these colleges. And they are in use not only for worship, where there are surprisingly many students showing up, and faculty, but they're also used for the ceremonial, for so much of what goes on in the colleges. And again, that helps form you. You know, most of us in the US, most universities here, if they do have a chapel, it doesn't get used much. And it's just such a different presence, where that presence is weighing on you, even if it's not believed in, the presence is still speaking because of the fact that those buildings are there and they have those centuries of prayer and worship in them.
Absolutely. It's at the heart of the kind of the English model of education, the Oxford model in particular, Cambridge as well, is that the college is there to feed every aspect of you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very often the chapel is next to the dining hall. Feed your body, feed your soul.
Right.
These are of equal importance. My old college, where I was an undergraduate, St. John's, they literally, when it changed from being a monastery, they swapped them round to make this point. So what was formerly the where you ate your food is now where your soul is fed. Where your soul was formerly fed is now where your body is fed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these two things are completely at the heart of the duty of the college to you. So it isn't just about cultivating your brain. You know, they all have their sports fields as well. It's about, you know, the improvement of your body. It's about everything. And to neglect the soul would be kind of unforgivable. It's got to be there. That is part of a true education, actually, is to pay attention to that as well as to, you know, grade points and all the rest of it.
Yes. All right. Well, that's a good place to take a pause. We could talk for hours. But go ahead and submit some questions and look at the ones that are coming in and upvote the ones that you like. And then, Wes, where are you? Okay. Whenever you are ready.
On. Hello?
Yes, there you are.
Good. All right. You guys ready? All right. Would you say that the turning away from liturgy has impacted the architectural expression of churches today? Think about non-denominational churches.
Yes. I think one of the things about liturgy, and I will say as a disclaimer, I'm biased here. I'm very biased. I'm wearing a collar. Fergus is probably biased too. But I will say that one of the things about liturgy that goes very much along with the tenor of the discussion we've been having is that liturgy is a way of entering into a sacred space, but in a different sense. And it draws you into the stream of people who believed in Jesus over the centuries. And sometimes, and I don't want to disparage non-denom churches because there's a lot of good stuff happening there, but sometimes what happens is it becomes the church of what's happening now. Mm-hmm. And it plays right into, if you were at Prince Caspian last week, we were talking about chronological snobbery, which is the idea that because we're alive now and all those other people are dead, we obviously, ipso facto, are way smarter than they were. And so whatever we think, if we can have a smoke machine and a screen and very contemporary things for a church service, well, that must be better because they couldn't do that back then. And if they could have, they would have. But I think that's a misunderstanding. And I think that there is a richness in the liturgical tradition that is rooted in an understanding of the transcendentals of beauty, truth, and goodness that's also reflected in architecture. What would you say to that?
I'd echo that. And I would say it's not that you cannot encounter the living God in a non-denominational church, right? In a plain atmosphere. But the comparison I draw is like, if you want to get in shape, right? I'm probably not the person to talk to you about that, but you
know, nor am I.
Were one to want to, so I'm told. Would you stand a better chance of going to a gym where there are people who know what they're doing, where there are machines there to kind of facilitate this, or would you do it simply in a bare room? You're running out on your own. Now, I'm not saying you cannot get fit by simply running up and down an empty gym. You can do that. But actually, if you want to exercise, you want to build that kind of pattern, it's much better that you get into a kind of established pattern, guided by someone who knows what they're doing, and around people who are doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. I think spiritually it works in exactly the same way. If you are seeking to encounter the living God, you're actually much better, or you're more likely to stick with that, if you are entering into rhythms that have worked for 1,000, 2,000 years, if you are surrounded by people who have made it their life's work to worship the living God, and if you are going into patterns of behavior which have drawn people to that living God for some time, as opposed to simply trying to start out on your own and just do it, you know, off the top. It's not impossible. I'm not saying it's impossible. I just know that I am a kind of weak and foolish person, and therefore having the structures in place is going to be
really
better
helps.
For me, right?
Yes.
And I think that's true of most of us. You know, you're more likely to stick to a kind of exercise regime if you're going to the same place where there are people who are telling you what to do, et cetera, than if you're simply saying, oh yeah, I'll get up and I'll do that tomorrow. That the reality of the human experience is we don't always do that thing. And I think that's perhaps the non-denom model is like, oh, well, you just turn up and you can experience Jesus. I'm sure that's true for some people, but it might not be true every week on week. And you haven't got anything then to hold you for the weeks when you're not experiencing Jesus. And that's the beauty of the liturgy. You know, there are days when I say morning and evening prayer from the Book of Common Prayer every day. That's part of what I do. It's priest of 1662. There are days when I wake up, and I won't say that I'm functionally an atheist, but there are days where I wake up and I have doubts and I have fears and I have problems. And I go and I say the same words as the days when I am filled with the love and faith of God. And those words hold me. They're like a cradle, the rocking of a cradle. The prayers of generations hold me. So I think that it comes down to the human fallibility needs the liturgy. We need these patterns because at the end of the day, they work.
Yeah. Great question.
All right. How can we make or bring the sacred into our personal spaces and homes?
Oh, I love that question. So I think one place that is sacred that you can bring easily into your daily life that we don't usually think about is that the creation is sacred. And being out of doors, some people will say the forest is God's cathedral. But I think being out of doors is a way to do that, to be fully present to the beauty of God's creation. Part of my daily practice is to do a prayer time outside each morning when I get up. If it's raining, I'll stand under the roof so I don't get wet. I don't want to participate quite that much. But that is sacred. I also think that there's a lot to be said. I have a little desk that is kind of my devotional desk, and I have a candle. I have some things that I love that are on that. And I read morning prayer every morning, so I have the leaflet that has that. And that's there all the time, and it's waiting. And so that is, for me, a place that is sacred. So I think that having part of what holiness means is set apart. So I think having space that is set apart can be very helpful.
Absolutely. I'd echo all of that. I guess I would add that times when you're with people as well is a very important thing. Yep. Again, Americans are so much better at this than Brits. Apart from actually in Oxford, where every meal starts with grace. But where we encounter God is in the breaking of the bread. You know, the road to Emmaus. You know, I can give you a million scriptural examples where God is encountered at mealtimes, right? Mm-hmm. From the Last Supper is the kind of great example. We have Holy Communion. We have the Eucharist as that kind of gift to us in our time. But actually, there is no reason why the table is a sacred place in a home. I really believe that. It's a place where you share fellowship and you share joy. It ought to be a place where kind of great, enjoyable conversations happen. Bread is broken, wine flows. It's happy, right? And so I think there's a kind of calling to pray before meals, to make sacred that particular place in a home. Certainly, I would absolutely echo what Brian says about creation and about setting aside a certain space, a place where you can pray, particularly when... You know, we talked about that problem of the third space. Consider getting your homes blessed, right? Mm-hmm. I think having someone come, particularly if you move to a new place, A, it's an excuse to get people around to share in the joy of a new home. Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorite things to do is the blessing of a new home, right?
Yep, mine too.
It's a really special moment. So if you haven't had that, speak to Brian.
We're available.
Yeah.
Yes.
This guy here can make that happen. It's a fantastic thing. And it just keeps you... mindful of this, of the specific sacredness of those parts of the house, right? Mm-hmm. The function of the kitchen is different to the function of the living room, right? Or to the bedroom, etc. But all of them have their place within the order of God's creation.
Yep.
And therefore, all of them can be blessed. And I think it's a very moving thing then to re-enter that room day by day and think, oh, this is a place that has been set aside for its purpose by God.
Yes. Great.
And thinking about spaces, what is the importance of Henry's for Tot?
That's actually a really good question. There's a reason that we're at Henry's. When Justin and I were first thinking about starting this, and we didn't know whether anyone would come or not, but we figured that we would enjoy a night together in the bar, even if no one else came. But we decided we wanted to do a tour of bars to try to find somewhere that would be a good space that would have some of the elements of what we think of when we think of a British pub, that would be not overwhelmed with screens. You will notice we had all the screens turned off for tonight. That would be a place with comfortable seating, that was warm, that was inviting, that was full of natural materials, all of those kinds of things. So we were very deliberate in looking, and Henry's had, for lack of a better word, the vibe that we wanted. And then the owner was loving the idea of what we were talking about doing, and so was very gracious in extending it without charge to us, which was a beautiful thing. But there's a resonance with being in the same space each time and remembering things that have happened there before, and all of that. So being in here is maybe in some ways a little bit of a ritual like that. And but a bar is a place that generally can be a place that of hospitality, of warmth, and of fellowship at its best. So that is what we are hoping for, and good conversation.
danger. I mean, I would simply say that there are many more profitable ideas shared in the pubs of Oxford than the colleges. So you're echoing that here. I think that's yep. a good thing.
Do you believe what is true and good and beautiful should impact the architecture of a new building, whether or not it is religious?
Oh, my goodness. I will try to restrain myself as I answer this question. I believe that wholeheartedly, and I think that it is a sub-optimization of the human spirit to build anything that is ugly. And one of the things that I loved about Joe Riley when he was the mayor, Joe Riley was our mayor for about 40 years and won every award that you could win about architecture and urban design. But one of his mantras that he would say, and he would work it into almost every speech he would give, is there's no excuse ever for government to build an ugly building. And unfortunately, there are ugly government buildings all over everywhere. And in recent years, there have been many blights on the Charleston landscape. And I think that part of it is because there's a misunderstanding of what it means to conceptualize a city, particularly a beautiful city. And so I think the best way to think about Charleston is to think of it as an old master painting. That is beautiful, that has lots of characters in it. And each building is a character. And in places where the painting has been damaged, what you want to do is to fill in that spot with great care and curating what you're doing. But many modernist architects are coming very much from the standpoint of, we need to make a statement. And we need to make a statement that we are not classical, and we have moved beyond that, and the values that we are expressing are the values of alienation and enemy and all of that kind of stuff. And so you get these buildings that are not on human scale, that don't have windows, that don't use proportions like the golden ratio and all of that, and those are buildings that people don't want to be in. It was quite funny, well, funny, sad, ironic. There was a horrific building that was proposed right across from St. Philip's that somehow, and there might have been a little money exchange somewhere, but somehow escaped the usual scrutiny. And it was this block-long building. It was the whole block between Church and State Street on Cumberland, the whole block, and it was this Darth Vader-esque black and gray glass and steel thing that looked sort of like a cross between an airport terminal and a parking deck. But the great thing about it was that even though it had already been approved by the time we started our protests, they were planning on using their pre-sales to fund it. It was going to be condos. No one bought them because they were ugly. And their whole shtick was be right in the heart of Charleston's historic district. Well, who wants to be in the carbuncle of Charleston's historic district in the building that everyone hates? And so now they're doing a lovely redevelopment of the old muse there. It's great. So I'm sorry I went on and on about that, but I feel very strongly about that.
Well, that final one reminds me of the French novelist Guy de Maupassant, who hated the Eiffel Tower, thought it was a hideous building. So he used to have lunch in it every single day because it was the only building in Paris that he could eat in and not see the Eiffel Tower from. So maybe we should have bought you an apartment in this.
That's
Brian,
it.
In
order that's
to,
it. Yeah.
But so I think to the point of the original question, you know, what is good and beautiful and true is the flourishing of God's people. Is God's people being, you know, treated as things beyond simply creatures of utility?
Mm-hmm.
And I think every building should have something on it which is useless but beautiful, that serves no purpose beyond the ascent of the human soul.
Yes.
Because that is, in fact, the highest purpose that anything, any physical thing, to go back to Bethlehem, can possibly be part of, right? So therefore, I think the idea, when we have buildings that exclusively exist for the sake of utility, it says something quite oppressive about the human experience.
Yes, it's reductionistic in the worst
exactly.
way.
Because if you just existed on utility, you'd sleep in a tube, right? You'd sleep in a tube and you'd have your food pumped in and other stuff pumped out.
You can do that in Japan.
Right, precisely. So if you existed exclusively for utility, you would not be involved in the beautiful and the hopeful and the true.
Yeah.
And so therefore, I think actually we it's a bit like you are what you eat. You become where you live and you become what you see. And therefore, I think we ought to have the useless and the beautiful around us as reminders of this kind of higher calling that every human has, to not simply be kind of these Borgs that walk around doing what utilitarian and demands.
And that's what people long for, and it's part of the reason that Charleston is so popular. Mm. Because if you're wandering south of Broad Street, there's hardly anywhere that you actually go in to do anything. All you're doing is just walking and looking. But the fact of the matter is, virtually everything in that neighborhood is built with these classical rules of architecture, and there's a harmony that invades your soul when you are walking through that, that people are drawn to. All right, I'll stop. Thank you.
Right. Let's see. What would you say about people saying the same thing about feeling God's presence in beautiful buildings for other religions, like Muslims and mosques?
I would say that the sense of being drawn to what is beautiful is hardwired by God into human beings in creation. And though I would not say that Islam is a true faith, it is inadequate, still the architectural expressions can be quite beautiful, and your soul can be drawn by that beauty because you are hardwired to respond to beauty.
I'd echo that. I mean, I've traveled across the Islamic world, and there are plenty of buildings that are breathtaking. They are astonishing. They are buildings that kind of force you. I would say generally the architecture of a mosque specifically is to make you feel small. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a deliberate thing. It's about magnitude. That is a very key aspect of Islam, the smallness of the individual compared to God. I would say that there is a fundamental difference, as I said earlier, between Judaism and Islam and other religions and Christianity, in that we have this truth of the incarnation, the idea of God become man, not as like a trick, not as a sort of temporary thing, but Jesus Christ is fully God and fully man, right? And therefore, places where God is present are not just like Mount Sinai, where you get the kind of distant glory of God, where Moses sees the back of God. It's not like, you know, Muhammad and the mountain, where again you sort of ascended in. God becomes a mewling child. God becomes a dying criminal. This changes physical space. So the point of Christian physical space, I would say, is what it makes us feel is our ordinary humanity being drawn into the love of God by the mechanism of grace, by the work of Christ, as opposed to, I'm a small little human. Isn't God great?
Yes.
Right? That is the difference. I think there is a quantifiable theological difference between what a mosque is trying to do, which, again, the awe of God, as Brian said, that everyone can feel awe. You can feel that when you kind of are in a natural landscape. You can feel that looking at the Empire State Building, right? You can feel that about secular physical spaces as well, about the magnitude. I'm small, this is big. There is something acutely different about the human physical enfleshed body and the physical space, the bricks and mortar being brought into the very heart of God, that really radical thing, you know, madness to the Greeks and, you know, horror to the Jews or whatever. Whatever translation you use here, I don't know. But this kind of really radical change that Christ brings about, that does, I think, have a really different mechanism to how Islamic or Jewish or other religious spaces work.
Yeah, and that goes right along. There's a wonderful quotation from C.S. Lewis that I'm going to botch, but he says something along the lines that when we're thinking about the incarnation, we usually think of it solely in the terms of God came down. Mm. But he said what the incarnation means besides God came down, he said, that's right, God came down and left footprints in the sand. But he said the even more glorious and important part is that by that, God drew up into himself all of our physicality and materiality, our footsore weariness, our glories, our shame, all of that was drawn into the heart of the Trinity. And that makes all the difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. What is the difference between a sign from God versus a coincidence?
Ha. Yes, that's a great question. If we could answer that, we could probably be rich. So I would say there are a couple of things to watch for. I think we are, as a culture, we are not mindful of the fact that God speaks to us, that God desires to speak to us through his word, through worship, through his people, all of that. So a lot of times, one of the things that's important is learning to begin to pay attention to that. And I think that if you are soaking yourself in the word of God and in worship and in your devotional time, and then something happens that seems unusual, it might be more than just a coincidence. I think praying into it is important to try to discern that, getting counsel from people. I don't think you want to base major life decisions on things that might just be a coincidence. But the flip side of that is I don't think you want to ignore things that are happening in your life.
There's a quote from a mid-20th century Archbishop of Canterbury, William Temple.
He's famously, very quotable.
Famously said, you know, when I pray, coincidences happen.
Yes.
When I don't, they don't.
They don't, yeah.
And I think, actually, there's no shame, I think, actually, in I just echo what Brian said about awareness. There's no shame in sometimes having a kind of sense, well, maybe that is a coincidence. Because if we look at Holy Scripture, God calls again and again and again. Mm-hmm. God makes sure that you know that it's not a coincidence. There's so many examples of people in the Old and New Testament, whether it's Elijah or Paul or Jeremiah.
Samuel.
Exactly. Yep. Jonah, Samuel, you name it. People who assume this is a coincidence. And they often go, you know, they go as far as throwing themselves into the sea and being eaten by whales, right? Because they're so convinced this is a coincidence or something they want to avoid, and God will make it unavoidable. So I think a kind of healthy... And praying around something, praying into something is absolutely critical. Just keeping an awareness out, you know, that's the kind of key thing. It's a bit like, do you obey the signs on the crosswalk or not? You know, if you don't and ignore them, the chances, the coincidence of you being hit by a bus is much higher than if you do obey them, right?
Yeah.
That's what prayer is like.
Exactly.
Yeah?
Yeah. And there's a wonderful quotation from the author and pastor Eugene Peterson, who wrote a great book called A Long Obedience in the Same Direction. Mm-hmm. And when he was being eulogized at his funeral, his son said, my dad said you could sum up his teaching in these words: God loves you, God is for you, he is coming after you, and he is relentless. And I think there's a deep truth in that can give us hope and confidence in dealing with coincidences. So on that, we are out of time. Mm-hmm. Thank you all so much for coming. Let's thank Fergus for being with us.
Thank you.
And there's lots of pizza, so please stick around and enjoy it.